Welcome, welcome, welcome. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining the session. Thanks for choosing this session over other three and over lunch. We haven't got anything to eat, but there are lots of brochures. It's great to be back here at the QE2. This is the best view in the conference scene. Of course, you know, the Abbey out the window is pretty phenomenal. But thank you for joining. We're going to sort of cover three major themes in this presentation. You've got the title here. The first is the new legal playing field, Economic Crime Corporate Transparency Act. Where is that? What's going on? We'll dig into Companies House and have a look at what's happening there and our favourite topic at Moody's of shell companies. We'll then think a little bit more about AI. We have to. But we've done some really important research. We spoke to 650 compliance professionals about where AI adoption actually is. So we'll show you some results, maybe do a bit of a straw poll in the audience about where you are with using this transformational technology. And then third, we'll turn the idea of this early warning signals and how we can distill that in detection into better and safer fraud prevention outcomes up front. And I'm going to show you a demo. It's sort of live, but it's been recorded. And it's double speed, so you can just sort of hear the guy talking, but you'll be able to follow through with it. So that's the plan. Yeah, here we go. Something you probably all agree with and recognise, you don't need me to tell you that. There are, however, some pretty shocking statistics on here. So while you look at those statistics, I'll tell you a story. This story is about Sharon. Sharon was enjoying her retirement in 2019. A 68-year-old received an email offering her a home-based commission job. 5 months into the job, Sharon discovered the job was, in fact, a task-based commission scam. That's a fake job that promises high returns but requires you to invest your own cash. After chatting online, Sharon fell for Mike. She confided in him about her money troubles, and Mike told her about a lucrative investment opportunity that guaranteed high interest returns, enabling her to pay off her loans. You don't need me to tell you how the rest of that story ends. You will probably know. This was reported as part of a regional policing effort in Staffordshire. This is one of 283 reports totaling £7.4 million of fraud between April and March 2024-25. And if you remember three things from this presentation, it's those stats on the bottom left. 300 victims of self-harm and suicide, £17.5 million of pension fraud, and £8,000 per victim of romance scams in the 75 to 84-year-old age bracket. We are living through a fraud epidemic, a scandemic, and what is happening is there is an expanded attack surface attacking increasingly vulnerable victims. So we have a new legal playing field. What has the UK government been doing on this in the last few years? It's a World Cup year, so forgive me for turning the playing field into a playing field. In the centre of the legislation, centre midfield, if you like, of the Economic Crime and Corporate Transparency Act, we've got two really important things going on. We've got Companies House enhancements and verification and the reforms around Company House. It's a millions of pounds of investment there from Bayes in evolving Company House. And we've got the failure to prevent fraud offence. And I'm sure you've all had the training, probably done the training on that too. And it's interesting because we've got the benefit of that flowing down to the private sector in terms of Company House. We've got the burden of the failure to prevent offence flowing down to the private sector from the enforcement. So what we'll do in the first part of the seminar is we'll look into each of these two and just see what's going on, where are we, and what are the things that we should be looking out for. Let's start with Companies House. You probably all remember this, maybe you don't, but I do, from 2023. This was a spate of high-profile, fairly embarrassing examples of UK Company House being used and abused by fraudsters at home. Internationally, it's well-recognised and renowned as a place where you can give a company the veneer of legitimacy so you can hide your criminal exploits. We'll come back to the shell company and the crypto scam a bit later on. And then on the right-hand side, you can see what's been happening. So in the last 3 years, including this year, quite a bit's been happening in terms of Company House changing. So 2024, we have the new statement of lawful business purpose, and we have a new appropriate address regime, so all companies filing, being asked to give much more information, not just about what they do, but how they're doing that, and are they legitimate, and equally, where's their address, and is that a mass registration or a PO box address that might require you to investigate that further. Last year, it was a big step change with the ACSPS regime, the Authorised Company Service Providers. That's a new centrally administered body with oversight from any AML authority. But on that list, there are, we checked this last month, 1,361 ACSPSs that are now certified. So most company formations go through a third-party entity, which is really good. So we're now starting to see more transparency, more control, more awareness of is your company being formed by an authorised agent. And then for the people at the register, the directors and the PSCs, last year for new incorporations, we had this ID verification, so verifying the PSC, the director, on the record. And what's happening this year is probably the biggest undertaking of work, which is all the data on the register, so the millions of companies that are there today, every time they go through confirmation statements, they'll be asked to do the same thing. So the directors and the PSCs will be verifying. Is it working? Well, it's quite early to tell. The way we looked at it is, I stood here a couple of years ago and presented on shell companies. So we ran a massive exercise across our proprietary Orbis database, and we decided on 7 different indicators of shell company behaviour. These are outlying behaviours of businesses that make you think you should stop and check. Are they real? Is the person behind them who they say they are, and what's the purpose of that business enterprise? What we've done is we've taken the 3 probably most probative indicators, and we've looked at formations in the last 2 years to see if they're in slowing down in terms of the run rate of these types of formations. So the first one is jurisdictional risk. This is the company, in a UK company, owned or controlled by somebody in a high-risk jurisdiction? So typically low transparency, somewhere where you might not have information who is behind the company, and there could be a reason why it's been set up like that to mask that ultimate ownership. So the trend actually across this indicator and the other indicators is pretty positive. We have seen a run rate slowdown. So in 2024, there are about 6,000 a month of those incorporations in the UK, down last year to 3,500, last 6 months, 1,500 rolling run rate of companies created with a high risk ownership in the UK. The second typology is outlying directorships. This is companies where the director has a high number of previous or current, so often someone who may have had that identity stolen and being used to create companies en masse, or could be very much just doing that as part of their business. But again, you might want to check, are they actually involved in the company formation day to day? Similar theme, dropping in sort of 40% down, 50% down on 2024. So good, encouraging signs. And then the third one that I think it's probably been most interesting for us when we've deployed this is our mass registration indicator. This is if a company is formed at the same time, date, location with a similar name as other companies, often the fake companies, the burner companies. So again, it's encouraging, right? We're seeing a decline in the run rate of production of these vehicles, but they're not going away. So you can still think that's 4,000 companies formed on average in the last 6 months with a mass registration. We dug a little bit more into mass registration, and we've built something new. So we've created a high-density address indicator. This is looking at specific postcodes in the UK and saying, well, is there a mushroom of lots of companies, again, being formed at this address? And that could be because they're at a lawyer's office or an ACSPS, but now we can triangulate where they're not at a lawyer's office or an ACSPS. This is a fast-food restaurant in Weston-super-Mare where 268 companies are registered at the postcode. Zion Global Limited is a money service business. It's Chinese majority owned, and it's the one that was selling the fraudulent cryptocurrency as part of the pig butchering scams in the article in 2023. And we also looked at Chinese company ownership as well in the last 10 years. Again, not all this is nefarious, but this is quite an interesting exponential curve. So in 2015, there were 700-odd companies formed in the UK with Chinese majority ownership. Circa 30,000 companies formed in the UK with majority Chinese ownership. So I think the bottom line to all that is we know that Company House is on a journey, but fraudsters are still taking advantage and abusing UK formation. What about the failure to prevent fraud offence? So there are 5 steps in this test. You've probably all done the training and given the training, so I won't labour on this. There are a couple of interesting ones that we spend some time talking to people about. The second and the fourth. One is just who is the person committing the fraud offence. And what's interesting about the offence is, like the Bribery Act from 2010, this is pretty broad. So not just your employees you've got to think about, but your agents, your service providers, your suppliers. If they're committing a fraud offence in the act of the service with you, then you could be ultimately liable for that fraud. And this UK nexus has got us very focused, certainly here in the UK. It's been big news, but not so much on the global scene. But there is an extraterritorial impact here. So if the fraud happens for a non-UK business or any international business, but the victim is in the UK, so if the service of maybe the e-commerce firm that you're using, the social media platform that you're on, is in the UK, then you could be liable and you might not be a UK business. So that's pretty interesting, and we are quite early in that enforcement cycle. The SFO guidance is good. We've read it, so you don't have to. I'm sure many of you read it. This is the thing that stood out for us, obviously. This is a step change in how due diligence is being prescribed. So we're seeing a much more specific focus on what you need to do to have adequate procedures. And it's having adequate and proportionate procedures that will help mitigate whether or not your organisation has a large fine or ultimately some criminal conviction. So, again, you can read it. Use of appropriate technology, for example, third-party tools, screening tools, internet searches, checking trading history, professional status or vetting checks. It sounds good. It also sounds quite old-fashioned, doesn't it? Checking internet searches and trading history. We're thinking about what sort of tools we have today to help us do that. But, you know, it's a good step forward in terms of thinking about practically. So inaction is no longer an option. This is a bit over the top, but bear with me. These are the four horsemen of the fraud apocalypse, and they're arriving at our door. And we can add legal exposure to financial loss, reputational, and the human cost of all of this. We'll see them again later on, and we'll see if we can slay these four horsemen, but they're knocking at our door. And I wrote that Gemini built that for me, because of this quote. So we produced a white paper. Some of you have it on your seats. It's interviews with several leading experts in fraud, both in the public sector and private sector. And this quote stood out for me. This is from ING, one of the biggest banks in Europe, and their fraud prevention team, and you can read that. It's all about customers losing trust in digital society and in everything. So when 60% of our relationships are built online, you can think about the degradation that has when something like this is so corrosive. So, yeah, again, back to the human cost and the daily work that you guys do. So what can people do differently? I'm going to focus a bit on two things. One is new ways of working, so organisational, culture, people. That's at the heart of combating fraud. And then we'll turn to technology and our research around AI adoption and where that is in the industry. So a few things on our collaboration models. I've taken three examples of recent programmes that we've been involved with. So from right to left, examples of org design, PPPs and innovative industry coalitions. So again, from the white paper, we've got the bank. And what's interesting here is the bank built an entirely cross-functional fraud prevention team, seconding in people from business, IT, communications and customer service to create a common shared purpose. So not necessarily people with any experience of fraud, not people who may be a fraud or a control or a legal function. That helps to really operationalise how they can prevent and detect fraud. Public-private partnerships, so this is Mark Knott from NECC talking about their engagement boards and bringing the banks, bringing the tech communities closer in to help on specific typologies, have real-time responses, ask questions. So again, this takes effort and investment, but we're seeing more of this. And at the sharp end, we've been involved with CFIT, which is the Centre for Financial Innovation and Technologies Coalition 2, Fighting Economic Crime Through Digital Verification. There was a readout a couple of months ago. It's worth following with what CFIT are doing. It's really interesting. So they're trying to build a digital company ID. So in Europe, we've got the IDAS regime, which is a passporting service and system for individuals and businesses being rolled out. UK is similarly moving forward in that direction. So Moody's, along with 70 other companies, were involved and government departments in piloting what could a digital company passport look like, what verification would be involved in it, what controls. Trying to move forward, both in helping to get a better sense of is that company legit, what's their history, sharing stuff across the street, but equally streamlining because the cost of doing this is also a big problem in banking in particular, and putting up costs of providing banking services to people. And then we've got the government perspective. So I dug this out of the functional strategy, which I'm sure you've all read, but this is objective two. So harnessing data and technology more effectively, advanced analytics, machine learning, and AI. So let's switch gears. Let's present to you a bit on our AI research. This is quite a major thing that we've done. So in 2023, we spoke to 650 risk and compliance professionals, and really to get a sense of where is your perception of AI, what are the risks, your concerns, your fears, what are the opportunities, where are you with adoption of AI? I'm not going to give you the full stuff. You can download all of it from our website. I've got four or five key takeaways just to set some context, and it would be great to kind of get a sense of where you are. I'll be asking you in a minute to raise some hands on this one. This is the first kind of major headline. So the blue is people who are, this is just risk and compliance people who are actively using AI in their risk and compliance function. And in 2023, we had 9%. Last 24, we had 11%. And then we did the survey again in 2025, we had 24%. And then we had the greeny, cyany colour, which was 21% again in 2023, jumped up to 29%. So a headline that got all the journalists excited here is that 53%. So a majority of people we spoke to last year were actively using or trialing, piloting AI in risk and compliance. There are variations between public and private sector. So for my curiosity, I'd quite like just a quick show of hands for people in the audience. So if you're actively using or trialing or piloting AI in risk compliance investigations, give us a wave. It's exactly 53%. It was a bit-ish. So, super interesting, right? We're all kind of, this concept of the future is now. I think we're all feeling that at the moment and trying to find what does that mean for wisdom and judgment and certainty, all the things that we are pride ourselves on as compliance and risk professionals. Other headline is work has changed forever. So 96% of people responded that as AI becomes embedded into day-to-day operations, that will impact their role. Right? This is pretty existential and for human beings to think about what does it actually mean to deliver value and work. 82% upskill, remain involved, 18%, you know, fearing reduced and de-skilled. So this is a really significant thing and society has to grasp with. Where is the opportunity in terms of the tasks that we do? Why is there a lot of people excited about this? Well, it turns out we still do quite a lot of repetitive manual things in our day jobs. Top answer, 23% said that was the main advantage they would see. 70% overall selected that as an answer. And you can read this graph in a few ways. You could say, well, that's fairly obvious. But if you read down the left, there's quite a range of cross-cutting activities that people are thinking about doing or doing. You've got helping address more complex scenarios. You've got sifting through the terabytes, the petabytes, the massive amounts of data that we're expected to be able to think about. And you've got this constant concept of accelerating decision and response times. So a lot of that risk assessment and evaluation and summarization is there and available to us. And what's interesting is the models are increasing at exponential speed and capacity, and our adoption is still fairly early on. So again, thinking about the next few years is even more interesting. Where is the opportunity in risk and compliance? So we asked to also kind of take it down a level. What about the day-to-day roles of compliance professionals? And top answer, again, pretty relevant for the audience here, is fraud investigations and financial crime detection, because we have huge amounts of data to try and grasp our heads around to make decisions. And these platforms are very good at bringing that centralization across that and helping us to make informed decisions. We did also ask, I've not got it in the deck, around how many people are happy with these things making decisions. This is probably one of the big topics. Keeping the analyst, the human in the loop. I haven't got the slide up, but I'll give you from memory of it. About 5% of cohort were happy for that to happen. 50% were saying, well, let's make everything and summarize I'll make decisions, 25% or so saying, don't make any decisions, just use it to automate process. But it was quite a varied set of responses. And again, that's also quite interesting, is that we all think about these things quite differently with our lived experiences of what we do. But we all have a sort of new view of what it means to be a compliance professional. So these are the common themes we asked, how will your role change? 61% of people answered taking on more of an advisory and strategic responsibility. 54% think they'll be more actively coordinating and developing and fine-tuning these tools. 53% more focus on handling exceptions and oversight. And 47% think they'll act more or act as supervisors of AI systems. And the final one from the research, this is probably the most important slide in this whole presentation. We wanted to correlate how your data quality and your AI effectiveness is. So this slide, this chart in the top left, people with superior or higher quality data were 2.5 times more likely to be actively using AI. And that quote's really nice. So data quality is determinant of effectiveness. LLMs can structure information that wasn't possible before, but they can't fix the underlying data quality. That's really, really important. So you can see a significant correlation between the quality of the data and the effectiveness of the AI adoption. So switching gears a bit more, what does this mean for investigations? So I've got a case study. We're going to reverse engineer it and see if we could do it quicker and better. And a few more quotes actually from the white paper before we get there. Data-rich but insight-poor. This one really resonates. We've got more data than ever before, but none of it talks to each other. By the time we've stitched it together, the risk has moved on. Which, how do you rationalise that against this one? Everything needs to be a split second. These are quite challenging things for us to reconcile in our day-to-day job. So let's look at this case. You might remember this one. Again, maybe it's just me that remember these things. This was in the Financial Times a couple of years ago. This is a company called Sten. This is really weird. Very curious story. So Sten was a fintech unicorn, almost, $900 million valuation. They were acquired by, well, their book was acquired by HSBC when Silicon Valley Bank collapsed, if you remember that. So HSBC got that book of business from SVB and included this company. They're an invoice financing company, so they pay invoices early on behalf of companies, take a discount, take a cut of that. That's their business model. HSBC noticed some weird things that were going on with Sten's book, and they called in the revolving credit facility, the underlying loan, effectively. And then pretty quickly, this company collapsed into administration. And this is from the court report, and you can see this was this quote from what the investigators found. So they'd not been making payments to the large blue-chip companies named on invoices. Instead, payments have been made to companies incorporated in countries such as Serbia, which have no connection to the blue-chip companies named in the invoices. The companies in connections also involved two Serbian individuals named in the documents, and all three companies have been placed into compulsory liquidation. And the headline says it all. These are fake companies. They were created to receive the invoices, create documentation to make the payment, but they had nothing to do with the companies that Sten thought they were paying. It is quite a curious case. The people behind it maintain innocence throughout, but yeah, it's very weird. The four horsemen are back. So these are the four horsemen of fraud risk. These are the early warning signals, and we'll peel the layer back on Sten, and each one of those four was flashing on the dashboard. We've got financial distress. So when a company is under financial distress, guess what happens? It puts pressure on the people who run and control the company, and they might make bad decisions. We've got shell companies, so the deliberate structuring of companies to be obfuscating ownership, to make it complex to figure out who's behind them. There's a reason why people might do that. We've got the previous history. So again, the SFO's guidance, the previous history. Past behaviour is not always indicative of future performance, but it is something you should be aware of when doing due diligence. And we've got network risk. That's not IT network. That didn't quite work on my Gemini. But that's meant to be the related companies and people involved in this business. Who else could have influence over the company? Let's look at the first one. So financial distress. This is our probability of default rating. We're pretty good at helping people figure out if companies are going insolvent or not. what the credit risk is, if that supplier will pay you. We've got quite a big business doing that. So we had Sten at a 12% probability of default. That's pretty high, anyone who works in financial controls. So that's pretty severe. First warning sign, financial distress, pressure on the business, pressure on the people. They might make bad decisions. We've got shell companies. So this is one of the examples of the ape fake companies. This is not Repsol, the multinational oil company in Spain. This is a Serbian-created shell company that had 7 million turnover with no employees in 2019. The two directors have also directorships over 135 companies. They were previously involved in 419 companies. And there were other examples of these companies that looked like big companies, but were just set up to receive those invoices completely innocently, with the owner of Sten not knowing about that. This is the owner of Sten, so the guy who's in control is a Russian national, Greg Kapovsky. Some previous history. He was involved in a Russian invoicing finance company that went bust, but again, professed his innocence throughout the whole case. And then we've got network risk. So actually, Sten's a far more complicated, convoluted corporate structure. This is from our investigations tool, MaxSight Investigations, where you can profile corporate structures, you can graph them, you can layer on social media. In this case, I like the sort of assorted collection of offshore entity structures and countries. We could play guess the flag, if you like. That's Curaçao at the bottom, BVI, and a Dutch sandwich into the island. That's great, useful, but in effect has taken me 15 years, right? I've been here for quite a while doing this. I've got a lot of experience. How could we supercharge and shortcut that? So the first thing you might do, for those who raise their hands who are using Copilot or Claude or Gemini, you might just do this. You might ask Copilot, which is now ChatGPT 5.0, run me a due diligence on Sten. You might get that back. It's not bad, is it? It's okay. It's financially distressed, under some scrutiny. They're an SME. It's okay. It's pulling on open source information, public data. Is it decision grade? Will it help you make a decision quicker, faster? Well, what if it knew all of this? What if it was grounded in a massive proprietary data estate? What if it knew information on 608 million companies, the 427 million people who own those companies, the 22 million adverse media profiles, the 325 cyber events? What if that LLM reasoning engine was grounded in accurate, trusted, and curated data? What might you get then? This is what you might get. This will help with hallucinations. It will help bring precision and inject that data into that reasoning engine. So we go from sort of, an entry-level analyst, maybe someone that knows a few skills, right? The analyst might know forensic accounting. It might be trained on the balance sheet to look at variations in liabilities and assets and say, hey, this looks a bit dodgy, investigate that. It might know who the company is owned by, when it was formed specifically. It might tell you there's some shell company indicators on the company structure and why that would be interesting, what offshore jurisdictions they were in. And it might know about the previous indictment and adverse media connected to Sten. And it might know about the invoice finance payment issues. So I'm going to run you a quick demo of how that comes together. The poor guy speaking doesn't speak this quickly, right? It was a 3-minute video, it's now 2 minutes, but hopefully you can follow along. Got to click again.
To a demo of the Moody's Agentic Intelligent Due Diligence Report, or IDD report. This report has been built via Moody's Agentic Solutions, where the agentic workflow automates the research and generation of intelligent due diligence reports in minutes instead of days of analyst work. There are two types of IDD reports available, the full report or the shorter lunch report. To begin the process of running a report, we choose one of the two available options and select run. At this stage, the platform has opened the agentic workflow and requires us to define a few parameters for the report. The first being identifying our subject entity. This can be done using the company name or Orbis ID. Second, we are required to input the name value of the entity to confirm the match. And lastly, we will be requested to confirm the choice of data for the report. For both the full and light report, there are two choices of data available, either curated data only, or data from registries and curated data together, otherwise known as waterfall. Once our inputs have been confirmed, We will do a final review before running the workflow. As you can see, the agent begins running through a workflow of predefined prompts that will enable the agent to begin scraping data from multiple Moody's sources and the web to generate our final report. On the right-hand side of the screen, you can now see the agent begin to build the report in real time. The agent has completed the workflow. We have three options to export the report, either as a Microsoft Word document, a PDF document, or a JSON file. We will export this report as a PDF. In the PDF report, we have a cover page followed by a clickable table of contents that will help us navigate quickly to the section of interest. As you can see from the report, the first section is an executive summary providing all key information about the requested entity. The next section of the report provides a background of the company, including management, ownership, and relationships. This is followed by a deep dive to perform some due diligence checks, both on the market and the sector where the company operates, screening for sanctions and adverse media. And finally, there is a section describing the approach, glossary, and disclaimers. Thank you for watching.
So what's happening there? The way to think about this is take a factory analogy. So there's a production line going on all the time with data being produced and curated. That's really the grounding, right? The data, the insights, what's that agentic workflow been looking at? It's not been looking at random websites. It's been told, these are the tools, these are the tasks, and these are the outcomes that I want you to go and think about. And my team has been heavily involved, expert interview third parties on curating. What does an ownership structure mean? What is a network analysis? Who are the executives? What are the kind of typologies we should be thinking about? And you can transform data. There's a concept of a model context protocol, a smart API. That's taking your data and transferring it, providing context so that an MCP, i.e. Copilot, Claude, any system, can take that data and do things with it. And then these agents are given very specific parameters. In that process, we saw there are tens of specific tasks happening. There's one saying, just look really specifically at the balance sheet and tell me if it looks normal based on Moody's information, but really specifically at the people who run the company. Let's look at the ownership structure. And then finally, there's a few agents sort of overseeing that whole thing. They're curating that. They're orchestrating it. They're providing quality checking. And they're told the overall task is to produce a due diligence report. So the four horsemen, slaying the four horsemen. Four takeaways. Fraud prevention due diligence is no longer optional. So fraud risk assessments, the due diligence that runs behind that is no longer a nice to have. And you've really got to think about recalibrating your risk assessments. And then is your due diligence taking into account the previous history? Is it thinking about the background checks? Is it summarising that information for you effectively? UK company formation is still being abused by fraudsters. Gen AI co-workers, agentic co-workers, they will become ubiquitous this decade. And poor data quality will limit their ability to help us fight fraud. And if we do some of that, we might slay some of the four horsemen. The graphics didn't quite work on this one, so AI needs to up its game. But we might experience reduced legal risk for the first time. We might lower our financial exposure. We might be able to turn our reputation into an advantage. And we might be able to bring back some of the human trust that's important in today's digital society. Thank you for attending. Happy to answer any questions.